Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So very glad that all of you have joined me today for a very, very special program, a very special broadcast. We have a visit today from royalty, and that's true. His name is Prince Reza Pahlavi. He is the son of the former Shah of Iran and the president of the National Council of Iran. He will be joining me on the Cross in the Desert in about 25 minutes from now. So you definitely want to have a front row seat. Really looking forward to talking with the prince this morning about his father, about Iran, and about what is happening currently in Iran with the nuclear deal and all of the things that are happening in the Middle East. I really, really pray this will be a very, very educational and informative program for you today. I want to welcome to the chat room my good friend, Mary. Yeah, no, the prince won't be on yet, Mary, just a little bit later. And I'm glad that you like the open. Yes, the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Stryper. Do you remember this band from many, many years ago? They're still around. Michael Sweet, the lead singer, they're incredible. And they are so patriotic as well. That's why I chose this open. Well, today on the Cross in the Desert, right before my interview with Prince Reza Pahlavi, I want to talk about an incredible new movie that talks about the resurrection, which is the foundation, the hope of the Christian faith. And this movie is unique. It follows a Roman centurion who is determined to somehow disprove the resurrection and somehow find the body of Jesus. And so it's an interesting, provocative, faith-challenging movie. And what I thought I would do today is explore the theme of the resurrection simply because it's the foundation for you and me as Christians, the foundation of our faith. And in just about a month or so, the world will be looking in on the church, if you will, and discovering why we are so excited about Easter Sunday. Well, it's all about the resurrection. And right now, I want to take you to CBN News for this special interview about the movie Risen. Let's listen.
A new movie is soon to hit theaters, and early reviews suggest it is picking up where The Passion of the Christ left off. Risen tells the story of Jesus' crucifixion through the eyes of a Roman military officer who is on a mission to prove the resurrection didn't happen. The star of the film, Joseph Fiennes, is sitting down with us for this week's Studio 5.
It's beyond us.
Spare me the riddles and zealot babble. Where did you take Yeshua? Is he a goblin? A sprite? Alive again somehow?
Open your heart and see.
I see delusion.
It doesn't matter.
A matter?
No.
Then give me the others and I'll grant you freedom.
I'm already free.
So, how do you get into the mind of Clavius?
To get into the mind of Clavius, I think it requires steeping yourself a little bit in Roman history.
Mm-hmm.
And I read several books, what it was to be a tribune, what a tribune meant, what were their duties. Because I felt that a big attraction for me was the way his mind worked. But what I found, to get to his mind, I found that I had to take a physical route.
Mm.
He's a man of war. He's in the industry of death, really. I mean, he's had a long career, and it's culminated in being a military tribune in Judea. And Judea, for a lot of those Roman soldiers, was the last place on earth you ever wanted to get posted.
Mm.
Full of insurgents,
yeah.
Full of sort of war every day. And so I went to, we spoke about this earlier,
mm-hmm.
I went to gladiator school in Rome. And,
how long did you stay in gladiator?
I stayed long enough to never want to go back. No, I spent a good part of a week working with a brilliant set of guys. And what I learned from a military standpoint, really for me, was the way into the way the man was conditioned mm-hmm. and the way that he thought. And that was really the beginning of the prep.
So you put your body through the ringer, too.
I did, and I'm still suffering from it.
Oh, no, what's still hurting?
Well, sort of odd, you know, muscles pulled and things like that.
Wow. So I know it was a physical journey for you. Was it also emotional?
Yes, it was emotional. We had a wonderful team of actors, and they were all very present and dedicated to the narrative. And it was all, like any great narrative and any great movie, it's about relationships. And, you know, I think your average good actor gets that and knows it and preps accordingly. So the disciples, as a group of actors, were incredibly bonded. They were a unit and a family. And I was very much polarized and outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got invited into the group, it was kind of like the arc of the film was pretty much the arc of my existence with them. I wouldn't have contact with them
mm-hmm.
Until we had kind of made those scenes where I had contact. Mm-hmm. So that became quite emotional, that journey. Being a part of the group was great, and I longed to do the scenes with the disciples than I did sort of having to be a Roman and fight all the time. But in particular, I remember the scene with Yeshua,
mm.
where Clavius, you're not quite sure if it's a dream sequence or it's happening for real, but mm-hmm. he's perched up on a rock and they're in the desert walking to Galilee. And he sees this vision of Christ and he goes to him. And I hadn't spoken to Cliff Curtis, who plays
yeah.
Jesus, who does a marvelous job. We never had contact, eye contact, vocal contact, anything at all. For, you know, nearly best part of 2.5 months. And then we got to do that scene. And somehow that separation, and we always knew we'd get to make contact, and we'd in our own ways prepped and probably built up a kind of, you know, our inner lives and stories and what these relationships and characters meant to each other. So when we came to film that, it was a powerful experience.
Mm-hmm. I, seeing it, felt it. Whose decision was it that you're not going to speak and this is going to be the first meeting?
That really came, I think, from the actors. I mm-hmm. think Cliff had prepped in his way, which is personal to him,
mm-hmm.
and the same for myself and others. and Kevin Reynolds, who's done an extraordinary job, our director, I think really built a set which was dedicated to the actors, going with their methodology, and that paid off.
Thank you so much.
You're
it
welcome.
It was an honor.
Special CBN interview, and that is Josephines. He plays the military tribune Clavius in the movie Risen. After serving 25 years in the Army, he arrives at a crossroads when he's tasked to investigate the mystery of what happened to Jesus following the crucifixion. This is a movie that hits the theaters on Friday. That's tomorrow, February 19th. And I would encourage all of us to go see this movie because it takes it from the perspective of the skeptic, the unbeliever who's not convinced. We as Christians know in our hearts, know by the testimony of Scripture, that this is a historical event, that the disciples didn't steal the body. Remember, the disciples preached the resurrection right in Jerusalem. And had they had done such a task of doing that, they were willing to give their lives for a lie when the Romans and the Jewish Sanhedrin were at their throats? No. It is a life-changing event, the resurrection, and there are so many good reasons why we as Christians hold to the reliability of Scripture and the truth claims of the resurrection. I remember, I guess I was 19 years old when my grandmother in Michigan died, and one of the presents that she willed to me was her own Bible. Now, at 19, you know how you are at 19. You think you know everything. Your mind is on everything else but that, on women, on careers, whatever. So here's this gift my grandmother gives me, and I loved the style of this Bible, the pages, the photographs. It was intriguing. And then I began to read. And what seized my attention first and foremost was the resurrection. And I remember when I would read the gospel accounts, I would think of my Catholic upbringing. We never went to church. I kept thinking, is this really true? And it was my grandmother's gift of a Bible to me that provoked me on a journey, on a search, just like this Roman centurion. Is it true? And the reason I was so drawn to the story of the resurrection was because at that age, I was preoccupied with the fear of death. It was not something I would speak openly about with my friends, maybe with parents, but this was what struck a chord in me. That was over 40 years ago. And let me tell you, it was the truthfulness of the resurrection that won my heart. And today I can tell you, as I think about this movie that's coming out, it could be the movie that could be a life-transforming movie for many, many skeptics like me that was once intrigued and thought about death. And guess what? When you meet Christ in the resurrection, you have hope, you have forgiveness, and you have assurance of your everlasting life. So let's put some facts on the table about the resurrection since we're talking about that this morning. I want us to go to Lee Strobel, who writes brilliant apologetic books for the Christian faith. And here's Lee talking about the truth claims of the resurrection on the cross in the desert.
Well, there are a lot of opinions about God. You look around the world, you see different religions, different beliefs. But to me, it comes down to where does the evidence point? And if Jesus claimed to be the Son of God and backed it up by returning from the dead, then that's good evidence that he is who he claimed to be. And therefore, his words are God's words. And his instructions for us are God's instructions for us, and we can know him personally, experience him on a profoundly deep level, not only in this world, but then ultimately in the world to come. So I look at, did Jesus return from the dead? And I look at the four E's to sort of summarize the evidence. The first E is for execution. Virtually every scholar, believer, non-believer, skeptic, concedes that Jesus was executed in the first century, 30 or 33 AD. You get laughed out of a major academic institution if you claimed otherwise. In fact, the atheist New Testament scholar, Gerd Ludemann, says Jesus' execution is an indisputable fact. Secondly, you have early accounts that Jesus rose from the dead. So it can't be a legend. It took a long time for legend to develop in the ancient world, at least two generations of time, for legend to grow up and wipe out a solid core of historical truth. But in the case of the resurrection of Jesus, we have historical data that goes within, it goes back to within months of Jesus' life. I mean, that is historical gold. And to me, it rules out the possibility that the resurrection is merely a legend. And third, he is for empty. We have an empty tomb. How do we know it was empty? Well, even the enemies of Jesus admitted it was empty. They conceded that when they said, oh, the disciples stole the body. That's just a cover story. They're implicitly admitting the tomb was empty, but they're saying, hey, we got an explanation. The disciples stole the body. Well, frankly, nobody believed that then. Nobody believes it now. Disciples didn't have the motive or the means or the opportunity. But the important thing is they were implicitly admitting that the tomb was empty. The question of history has never been, was the tomb empty? Everybody admitted that. The question was, how did the tomb get empty? That's really the issue. And you look at the various options and you say the disciples weren't about to steal the body. Why? So they could live lives of deprivation and torture and suffering as a result? I don't think so. The Romans weren't about to steal the body. They wanted Jesus dead. The Jewish leaders weren't about to steal the body. They wanted Jesus to stay dead. I think the best explanation for the empty tomb is that Jesus rose from the dead, especially when we combine it with the fourth word that begins with E, which is the word eyewitnesses. That Jesus appeared alive in a dozen different instances to more than 515 individuals, to skeptics and doubters, as well as to believers, indoors and outdoors, to groups, to individuals. People talked with them, they touched them, they ate with them. I mean, think about that. That's 515 eyewitnesses. I was a legal editor of the Chicago Tribune. One of my jobs was to travel the country and cover major trials. I never saw a trial with 515 eyewitnesses. That's a pretty large amount of persuasive evidence. So I put these four E's together, the execution, the early accounts, the empty tomb, the eyewitnesses. To me, that is a powerful case for the truth that Jesus rose from the dead and thus authenticated his claim that he is the Son of God.
He is an awesome, awesome author. And I'm speaking of Lee Strobel. If you've never had an opportunity to read his books, The Case for the Resurrection, one of the books is The Case for Faith, The Case for a Creator, The Case for Christ. These are excellent apologetic books. They're written in such a style and a way so that they're not boring, they're not heavyweight, detailed, but they are thoroughly researched and well thought out, and they are very enjoyable to read, and I highly recommend Lee Strobel. That acrostic is very helpful to us. The empty tomb, the early manuscripts, the eyewitnesses, these help us to put together a good cohesive case for the truth claims of the resurrection. When we talk about this, why is this so important? Because Jesus conquered death and hell and obtained forgiveness. He gives us hope. We have everlasting life when we trust in Christ. This is a monumental event. This is the good news of the gospel. If Jesus be not raised, all of our hope and all of our preaching would be in vain. But it's not. It's based on solid, historical, life-transforming evidence. And I want to thank Lee Strobel for helping us to understand that. Now, there is one more interview I want to go to, and that is from Michael Lacona, who wrote a book defending the resurrection when talking with Muslims. And he also will help us solidify our faith in some core facts. Let's listen this morning to Michael Lacona on the resurrection.
Welcome to the 1 Minute Apologist. My guest with us today is Mike Lacona, who is an author and sought-after speaker. He has co-authored a book on the resurrection with Gary Habermas. It's good to be with you, Mike.
Well, you too. Thanks.
Hey, listen, if you could just help us to understand this idea of the resurrection. We know it's been under attack ever since it's happened.
Well, I think the first thing we would do is we would look at some facts that would be so strongly evident that they have convinced nearly every single scholar who studied the subject to regard them as historical facts, including skeptical ones. That would be things such as Jesus' death by crucifixion, that subsequent to his death, that Jesus' disciples had experiences that they interpreted as Jesus appearing to them risen from the dead, and that these occurred in individual and in group settings. And third, that there was a skeptic, a persecutor of the church named Paul, who converted to Christianity when he had an experience that he believed was of the risen Jesus appearing to him. Now, this would be like a modern-day Osama bin Laden, who has an experience and then converts from Islam to Christianity to his own demise and preaching to the Muslim world and gets stoned for it. This is kind of like what we're looking at with Paul. So now, as historians, what we want to do is we want to come up with a hypothesis that will best explain these three facts. And we would do this, determine what's the best hypothesis by saying which one accounts for all three facts, rather than just one or two, which can account for them without bending them or forcing them to fit like a square peg in a round hole. And third, what can we do it without any, which hypothesis does it best without any non-evidence assumptions? And the resurrection beats the others hands down. So, for example, the leading naturalistic explanation, hallucinations, it can account for Jesus' death by crucifixion. It can account for the appearances to individuals, but not the group appearances, because hallucinations are not group phenomena. And it can't account for the appearance to the skeptic Paul, because he wasn't in a state of grief. So, I mean, you could kind of force those to fit, but then you lose explanatory power because you're forcing them to fit. With resurrection, all three fit very easily. If Jesus rose from the dead, it explains his death by crucifixion. Why numerous people in individual and group settings believe they saw him risen from the dead, and why even a skeptic saw him risen from the dead. So historically speaking, forget, you know, assuming that the Bible is trustworthy in any manner. Just taking the facts upon which most everybody agrees on, you can come to the resurrection of Jesus as the best explanation, and thus we should regard it as an event that occurred in history.
I think it's a very cohesive argument on the 1 Minute Apologist, Michael Lacona. Especially, he deals with the objection of hallucination. Now, does it mean that people don't have hallucinations? Well, of course, people do. There has to be a conditioned environment for those. Now, you could say, well, the disciples were grief-stricken. Jesus had been, you know, crucified. But this is a group. Groups do not simultaneously have the same hallucination. And the problem with that theory of hallucination is that they touched him. You can't touch a hallucination. Jesus said, "Behold my hands and feet and touch me, for a spirit has not flesh and bone, as you see that I have." And so Jesus himself refutes the idea of hallucination, if we are to take the eyewitness accounts of the disciples seriously. I like what 1 Corinthians 15 has to say about the resurrection. Paul says, "I passed on to you what was most important and what also have been passed on to me. Christ died for our sins. Just as the scripture said, he was buried and he was raised from the dead on the third day, just as the scripture says." This is an early account most historians and scholars will date. This creed that Paul is quoting from in 1 Corinthians 15, as early as 54 A.D., this is hardly making a case for legend. This is 20 years after the crucifixion and resurrection that Paul is quoting this creed. It was passed on to him, and it can be dated that long ago. He was seen by Peter and then the 12. After that, he was seen by more than 500 of his followers at one time, most of them who are still alive, though some have died. So there was actual eyewitnesses when Paul wrote this that you could confer with about the truth claims of the resurrection. And so I just wanted to center in on this topic this morning and urge you to go check out the new movie, Risen. I think it will be a very, very strong, life-transforming experience for those that are skeptics and question the validity. What I want to do now is talk a little bit about my upcoming guest that I'm very excited of interviewing this morning. And I'm speaking of Prince Reza Pahlavi, son of the former Shah of Iran and now the current president of National Council of Iran. He was the first child of Mohammad Reza Shah and Queen Farah Pahlavi. He was born on October 30th, 1960. And since his childhood, he learned to serve his nation. At the age of 3, Reza formally attended his mother's coronation ceremony as the first woman who was crowned in an Islamic country. He was always present in all of the ceremonies. He was very interested as a child in soccer. And his perseverance among athletes since his childhood and teenage years is the reason why he still enjoys special popularity amongst other Iranian athletes. Now, fast forwarding, Reza left Iran for pilot training at the age of 17, which was about 1977. This is right before the Iranian Revolution and the events that led up to it. And as a result of that, he was forced to live in exile after the establishment of the Islamic State in Iran. Now, Reza was educated in political science at the University of Southern California, and he completed his jet fighter pilot training course at Reese Air Force Base in Lubbock, Texas. During the Iran-Iraq War, Reza wanted to volunteer and join his country's army as a pilot and do whatever his parents had taught him, that is, serving his country and countrymen to fulfill his duty. But his request was not accepted by Khomeini. After the revolution and after the establishment of the Islamic State in Iran, Reza Pahlavi could not neglect sorrow, war, chaos, poverty, drug addiction, prostitution, numerous executions, imprisonment, and torture of his fellow citizens. Instead of concentrating on his own personal life or living a prince's life in a prince world and being busy with social affairs, Prince Reza Pahlavi selected to defend the rights of his countrymen. His simplicity, dignity, and magnanimity is famous for today's youth. He even defends the rights of those who did harm to his family. And he is a champion of defending the rights of women in Iran. After the 2009 Iran presidential elections and events and the youth crackdown on the Green Movement, he founded the National Council of Iran in Paris with the help and effort of the youth in Iran. In April 2013 is when the actual official date of founding National Council of Iran took place. Now, the Iran National Council, or the National Council of Iran, its aim is for holding free elections. And the council is fighting against the totalitarian Islamic regime with the support of all Iranians. Many letters related to executions and the plight of political prisoners and prisoners of conscience have been sent to the UN Secretary General and the officials of the countries of the free world, and the sites of Iran National Council are still emanating daily news on human rights violations in Iran. As the president of Iran National Council, by providing an economic, political, and social platform for the future of Iran, Prince Reza Pahlavi aims to prepare the conditions for the holding of a free and fair election through a transitional government. It is an honor for me to welcome Prince Reza Pahlavi right now to the Cross in the Desert. And good morning, Mr. Pahlavi, and welcome to the Cross in the Desert.
Good morning, Mr. Noble. It's wonderful to be with you on your program.
And if it's okay with you, sir, I'd like to call you Prince Reza Pahlavi because all of my Iranian friends like that title, and if that's okay with you.
Well, I'm not the one who's focusing on titles right now, but if it pleases people, it's up to you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, sir, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be a guest on The Cross in the Desert. And the subtitle of my program is Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran, which is really the whole reason why I do this program. Iranians are precious to my heart, as to your heart as well. This year, Mr. Pahlavi, we're looking back 37 years ago to one of the biggest events in history, and that is the Islamic Revolution. I would like for you to please share with us your memories of Iran and of your father, the great Shah of Iran, before the revolution. Could you do that for us?
With pleasure. I have amazing memories of my youth. You may know that I left the country just the next day after my high school graduation. So I spent my entire teenage years in Iran. And as I was growing up, Iran was really a country that every year was simply improving in the positive direction in terms of infrastructure, in terms of health, in terms of education, in many aspects. And in that context, I could only be witness to my father's resilience and commitment to the betterment of our country. He was a true patriot, and he was truly caring about every aspect of things in Iran. For instance, I know for a fact that the first report that he would get every morning, even before stepping into his office, was what was the latest precipitation in terms of rain around the country. He was concerned about our agriculture. He was concerned about many aspects of social life, women issues, which was, I think, perhaps the highlight of his extensive work for the country, and what brought to Iran an era of modernity and progress. I used to sometimes travel along with him during his different visits to different locations for his work. Of course, I was studying, so I didn't have that much time to participate in that in my younger years. But also when we had moments of rest and relaxation during vacation, those were perhaps the best intimate times that I was together with my family, my siblings, my mother, and, of course, my dad. And in particular, I remember when we used to go to the summer shores of the Caspian Sea for the summer, and really wonderful memories that I have from that period before all of a sudden we were faced with the crisis that unfortunately led to this religious revolution.
Now, you had mentioned that at about the age of 17, you left for pilot training, and it was at that time when the events began to happen in Iran that culminated in the revolution. I imagine being in another country at the time this was happening and unable to travel back, this had to be one of the most difficult, tragic moments of your life.
Indeed. I left Iran about 6 months before my parents did. I left around June of 1978, and my parents left the country for the last time on January of 79. So I was earlier out of the country. As I said to you, I had just graduated from high school. The plan was for me to attend Reese Air Force Base, the U.S. Air Force pilot training program. I was already flying back home. I used to fly all sorts of planes, including the F-5 jet fighter. But the idea was for me to familiarize myself more with the United States, and the plan was for me to return to Iran after undergoing that pilot training program to most likely attend the Iranian Military Academy. Of course, none of that unfolded. In the middle of everything, we were caught in the crisis. I was monitoring from afar the circumstances, all the upheavals, and, you know, once at the time it didn't quite register that we may be condemned to a life in exile. But that's the basic difference between people who emigrate and people who are forced into exile. You're not outside of your home by choice. You're forced to accept that as a, you know, as part of the struggle for freedom. And that taking away from you your most God-given right as a citizen of a nation to be among your peers in your own country is indeed one form of suffering that is different, of course, from torture and physical sufferings and repression and humiliation that many of my compatriots, unfortunately, have endured every single day since the regime has come to power. But we all have a commonality of facing all of these difficulties wherever we might be, outside or inside the country.
What I really appreciate so much about your story, Reza, is the fact that once this happened to your father and to your family and to your country, you literally have devoted your life to fighting for democracy and freedom from Iran. And you have taken your suffering and you have said, I'm going to do something for my country. I'm going to do something for Iranians. And in 2013, you formed the National Council of Iran. And explain to us, what are the main goals of the National Council of Iran and what can we do to reach out to Iranians through that?
With pleasure. First of all, Randy, let me just say something that you just mentioned. As an Iranian, it was always and it continues to be my duty to serve my country towards its best interest. And what has prompted me to dedicate my life is because I couldn't simply sit idle. That was my own internal motivation to be able to do everything that I can so that Iranians can attain what they have always desired. Having said that, throughout all these years, countless of my compatriots from inside or outside have come to me, chatted with me, hugged me, cried with me, and they always keep saying that, don't forget something, you don't belong to yourself, you belong to us. And in that sense, how could you possibly refuse the challenge? So you know, I do it wholeheartedly with no regrets, and until the day that Iran is free, I will not relent. Having said that, let me explain to you a little bit more about what brought in the nexus for the formation of the Iran National Council for Free Elections. In 2009, as you recall, we had that fiasco with the elections that pretty much forced the Green Movement, which was protesting the result of that cheating by the regime, when countless of my compatriots were either executed, tortured, imprisoned, and really quashed by the regime forces. At that time, I thought that this is a momentum that goes well beyond simply questioning the result of a fraudulent action by the regime. It's a much more deeper desire for people to use every opportunity to voice their disenchantment towards their rights to self-determination and the freedom to choose whoever they want to put in office in the political system of the country. That movement could not have been led to simply, fade away. So what brought this idea was a series of discussions that I had with a number of people, starting first and foremost by Iranian human rights and civil activists, as well as political prisoners. In fact, the first draft of the charter of the Iran National Council came out of Evin prison. And we spoke with a number of various political organizations and groups, even though ideologically they were diverse, but with the commonality of one purpose, where we all stand as secular Democrats saying that as long as you have a clerical dictatorship, there cannot possibly be the situation whereby it will be conducive to democracy, to self-determination, to free elections, to human rights, etc. I'm telling you all this in a nutshell. So basically, we established the Iran National Council with the objective to first offer an alternative as a system of governance to the current clerical theocracy. In other words, we believe that a parliamentary secular democratic system is a mechanism that universally today is being accepted for most democratic nations, where there's a checks and balance system, where the judiciary is independent from the executive and the legislation, et cetera, and all the necessary mechanisms that can be the watchdogs for society to prevent any kind of divergence from the democratic track in any given country. Now, we are faced with a regime that obviously is trampling on these rights, where you cannot have free elections, when everything is filtered, when people are barred or disqualified because of their gender or their political ideology or whatever you have. And as such, we cannot say that what exists in Iran today is legitimate or is acceptable to the people. So the Iran National Council offers this challenge that since the regime will not voluntarily step aside and allow for such a climate to prevail, we have no choice but to have a campaign of civil disobedience to ultimately force the regime to backtrack and hopefully at the end of the day collapse, but also offer an alternative so we don't have a vacuum. The Iran National Council goes beyond the fact that this regime has to go. We are focusing on a period where there has to be a transitional period, a transitional government, to lay the foundation for all the constitutional process, to draft a new constitution. Ultimately, the people will have to adopt such constitution, determine the final form that this secular democracy will take, and at the end of the day, we will have normalcy in the political sense back in the country. Even beyond that, Randy, what's important for me, apart from just this transitional roadmap, is a long-term vision for Iran. Let me tell you what I mean by that. In 1979, the opponents of the previous regime were focused on the concept that let's get rid of the Shah, then let's see what happens. Well, guess what? We now know the results. The Iranian people cannot be faced with a scenario whereby the only option is to say, let's get rid of this regime, then we'll see what happens. No. The difference is that today we have to tell people, why is this regime not good? What could be better for them? How can they get to it, and what's their role in it? Short-term, mid-term, and long-term. By long-term, I mean the next 50 years. In every aspect of the country, not just the political structure, but also in terms of health, education, all these various sectors of society that have their own problems, from workers to tribal elements to ethnic groups to religious minorities, you name it. The environment, so many issues that we have to all focus collectively. that's the basic idea behind the Iran National Council, which I have the honor to preside, which was formed about 3 years ago.
This is very interesting that you bring up this very comprehensive plan, and I want to ask you, for those that are critics and don't believe in the plan, they say there can be some possible reform. What do you say to your critics that say, well, this regime can be reformed?
Well, you know, how many times do we have to test the same theory and only come with the same result? As Einstein said, doing more of the same, hoping for a different alternative, is a sign of insanity.
Mm-hmm.
This regime is not going to reform itself because its entire existence depends on one simple objective: export a radical, ideological, twisted version of what religion is all about beyond Iran's border across the world. They will stop at nothing in achieving that. Don't you ask yourself, Randy, that after 37 years, don't you think that by now, if there was any aspect of stability or security, this regime would continue to execute people, would continue to incarcerate all sorts of people, execute and murder Baha'is, persecute Christians, kill a poor young girl who was only defending herself in self-defense, and they execute her for having murdered her assassin. You know, you're very close to that story yourself, Randy.
Yes.
That a young child was taken out of
a
hospital in the middle of a procedure when he was getting stitches, and when the doctor finds out that they don't have enough money to pay, he removes the stitches and sends that little poor kid back home. If this regime really cared about the people, it wouldn't do everything that it does. And in terms of reform, we all know candidates are filtered, they're disqualified, left and right. There's no presence of any kind of political parties or secular parties. The only party that they call is the party of God, Hezbollah. And that's basically everybody that is tied to this regime and their cronies. And on top of it, you have a paramilitary mafia that is in bed with this regime, and they basically watch each other's back, unfortunately, to the detriment of the Iranian people. So I think the evidence is out there that this regime has no true objective to change its nature. In fact, if it were to do that, it would no longer be what it is.
Exactly. All we see in Iran is fear and oppression, and there is no freedom. Now, this past summer, Mr. Pahlavi, you witnessed and I witnessed our government sitting down and signing a nuclear treaty with Iran. And there are so many things I want to ask you about this particular agreement, but I would like to get your reaction to what you thought about the performance of our government signing a nuclear deal and its negotiations with the Iran, the Republic of Iran, without dealing with the biggest issue of human rights.
Let me tell you one thing, Randy. First of all, the Iran National Council, and also my position along with it, has been supportive of the idea of this agreement only to the extent that it at least avoided a conflict, a military conflict with my homeland, which would have been lose-lose. Having said that, there's not much left to be desired. I think the overall problem, not just vis-a-vis Iran, is basically appeasement rarely has achieved positive results. We remember the days of Hitler. We're dealing with people in a position of force that will lie their way to achieve whatever they want. And based on what most experts have said, the real aspect of this negotiation simply meant that instead of a 3 month window where they could manufacture one bomb, now we're talking about 12 months. And what guarantee do we have that the watchdogs can, in fact, impede the regime from going back to it again? But as you said, and I'm glad you asked the question, well beyond the Iranian nuclear agenda, the questions of human rights is paramount. And why do I say this? And mind you, not just about Iran. Look at the entire region. Everything that this regime has started from the day of its inception in terms of radicalism, regional tension, instability, today a conflict between Sunnis and Shiite Muslims that did not exist back then when we had cordial relations, not just with the Arab world and the other Muslims, but even with Israel. Iran had good relations from Pakistan to Turkey to Saudi Arabia to Egypt to Jordan to Israel to even the Soviet Union. So when you look at what has led to this instability, to waves of immigrants, it's because at the core of the problem. There is absence of liberty. There is no guarantee that citizens are treated equal. There is fanaticism that is overtaking what the silent majority tries to shy away from, but they are powerless. And unfortunately, most of the dialogue that has existed all these years in terms of the U.S. government, and I'm not isolating just the U.S., mind you. I think a lot of the European allies have pretty much carried the same policy overall. The dialogue has been restricted to these regimes and their representatives. How often there has been a true dialogue with the legitimate representatives of an opposition? What has been done to empower them? What has been done to encourage people that, you know, we are not going to let you down. We're not going to jump over your heads. We're not going to cut a deal for the sake of expediency. And in that sense, allow for further instability. In all this, when you look at it from the Western point of view, the U.S. and its allies, and we look at today's regional turmoil, the role that Russia is playing, we are seriously getting close to a potential Third World War. I'm not being an alarmist here. Look at the way the media in Europe is now covering what Turkey is doing to the Kurds, who the Russians are bombing, what the Saudis are sending in terms of military forces, and all those warnings and ultimatums that are being issued. I know Americans today are focused on the electoral process here in America, but a lot is happening out there, and that's something that could be cause for trouble if there's not a shift in focus and additional steps taken to further elaborate on what really needs to be done and not simply try to contain the problem. What it has to be solved. Yeah. It cannot be just contained.
I totally agree with you with the instability in the Middle East with the signing of this treaty. Iran, of course, has ties to Hezbollah and Assad in Syria, and there is such a potential there. I agree with you, and it's not being an alarmist. We're being a realist. I want to just shift our attention for a second to the upcoming elections in Iran. I know I've talked to my Iranian friends, and basically they are told they must vote or their benefits will be revoked from them. And a lot of times the Guardian Council, of course, chooses those whom they want. But can you talk for a few seconds about these upcoming elections and what they are going to mean for Iranians?
Well, you pointed to one aspect that is unfortunately the sad truth about how the regime blackmails people, forcing them to elect against their will, because students will not get their ID card stamped to continue their studies. Government employees will be fired from their jobs if they don't vote. That's sheer coercion. Is that tantamount to a free and fair process of democratic elections? Of course not.
No.
But why is the regime doing that? The regime is simply doing that because at the end of the day, it wants to announce to the entire world, look, people are participating in our elections, therefore we have legitimacy. That's all it means. That's all it means, Randy. It doesn't mean anything else. Now, there are some people who have heeded my call by saying not voting in itself is a vote. Why should we, even if it means that we have to sacrifice, legitimize this regime? So at the end of the day, and you look at now how bravely civilians, advocates of human rights, public defenders, people who are the intelligentsia, more and more are coming out in daily protests in various sectors of our society. People have had it. You cannot constantly believe that the regime could continue ad nauseum deterring people or humiliating them or threatening them or blackmailing them. But there's a huge element that is missing, Randy. Many of my compatriots, including those who are standing up against the regime, who risk being reincarcerated, who risk all sorts of dire consequences, not just being fired from their job, that would be easy, but are facing torture and imprisonment, perhaps even execution. What's very important in what they say is, look, we're doing our part. Where is the free world? Where do we hear from them backing us up, defending us? And, you know, when there is legislation, when there is policy, when there are statements they hear here and there of gutsy, courageous heads of states and politicians who say, we will not normalize relations in Iran so long as human rights keep being violated, we'd like to hear that coming from the United States as well. Angela Merkel has said that recently. Many of the French officials have had the toughest position. Many people have been frustrated by the way the U.S., to say politely, lack of resolve in being more aggressive in standing firm. This is not the way you hearten people. This is how you demoralize people and lose people's trust as the beacon of liberty and hope. America could do much better than that. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we are now entering an era where it will probably be on the plate of people who today are campaigning to become the next president in this country. And
yes.
I think in that sense, they have to refocus on what's really at stake here. This is not just, not under my watch, I don't want any trouble, but the future of the planet is at stake. We can avert a third world war if the right decisions are made right now. And we stand ready to talk and assist in discussions with anyone who wants to know more about this. And I have thoughts on that if we have some time to discuss this.
Yes, I'm so glad that you mentioned about the candidates. I was going to ask you what your message, what's your direct message, if you could sit down with the presidential candidates and focus on the issues that matters most without all this mudslinging that's going around, Mr. Pahlavi, what would your message be to the individual candidates?
Okay, in principle, Randy, I would like to offer this sort of like an image for a second for all to understand, in particular to Iran. I'm not going to speak on behalf of other nations like what's happening in Syria or elsewhere, but in Iran improper. It's always a complex issue when you deal with the Middle East, right? Understanding
yes.
people's mentality by itself cannot be done by reading a couple of books or traveling twice to Tehran and going to the bazaar and have a cup of tea and think you know all about that country. It takes much more than that. But in a political sense, I would today, at this instance, talk to you about three, maybe four distinct categories of people you're dealing with. Category number one are all those currently in power in Iran with their self-interest in preserving their power base and what they have. I think we know who they are, what they stand for. This is definitely not something that you could ever come to terms with. The second group are people who don't mind being part of this system, and to them it's a power struggle. It's being part of the establishment, albeit that power falls into their lap as opposed to those who are currently in power. So it's a power issue. The third category are people who are out there to hope for normalization simply because they went to make some money and have some business and couldn't care less necessarily about the human rights violation or what have you. And then finally, you have the fourth category of people to whom I belong, I believe, who are those who believe in the fundamentals of what Iran is lacking today in terms of what would be justice, what would be freedom, what would be conducive to any citizen not feeling in any form or shape discriminated against because of his religion, because of his sexual orientation, because of his political ideology, because of his ethnic background, etc. So the question is, who do you want to talk to have a better picture of what needs to be done? People who actually care about the country or those who don't give a damn? If you base your opinion on reports of those who don't talk to the fourth category, you're still going to miss a big part of the picture. So what I have to recommend to candidates or anybody currently in a position of decision-making that has something to do with foreign policy and that part of the world is to make sure that beyond some regular channels of intelligence and analysis, try to spend some time hearing it from the horse's mouth, hearing it from the average man on the street, hearing from Joe the plumber in Isfahan and Mashhad and Tehran. You know what I mean? That's
yes.
the part that has been missing. Now, I understand it's not easy. I understand that people have busy schedules. I understand that this is delegated to some staffer or God knows what else. But you know what? It's a different thing when you look in the eye of a young girl whose father was killed, or a brother whose sister was raped, or a worker who has lost a friend who was an activist who was jailed, tortured, and ultimately murdered. It's a different thing when you understand the part that leads you to understand how much is at stake here. We're not just talking about business. We're not just talking about money. We're talking about people's lives. We're talking about our planet getting together and have this solidarity at the time that we most need it. And that's the part that I think would go a long way in giving all those who are involved in this process a much better picture, or at least a more, I would never say complete, but a much clearer picture of what's happening over there.
Well, Mr. Pahlavi, your passion for Iranians is so obvious, and I completely agree with you, and I join you in being a voice for them. And I agree that this is the best approach for giving hope and freedom to Iranians. The goals of the Iran National Council are excellent goals. It's a very comprehensive, well-thought-out plan. And connecting our candidates with real Iranians so that they understand that this is not a political issue, this is human rights, this is life. I want to thank you so very much for educating us today on the cross in the desert.
Well, I appreciate that, Randy, and my thanks to you and all your good work in that direction and all of those who participate and contribute to be in solidarity, because I think we can all, at the end of the day, stand proud having achieved something together to that end. I appreciate the time you have given me, and I hope to have a chance to chat with you again soon.
You're always welcome on my program. That is the voice of Prince Reza Pahlavi of Iran National Council, really educating us today about Iran, because it's all about hope, and it's all about freedom, and it's all about human rights. And I thank Mr. Pahlavi for giving us this time and really, really passionately informing us about what's happening in Iran. It's 10:26 on the cross in the desert. And I want to shift gears a little bit for you here. I want to introduce my next segment on the program. We are going into the sound check today to listen to the excellent Christian music of Todd Agnew. Very, very special guest this morning on the sound check, and it's all about Todd Agnew. And when Todd Agnew began his career, he wasn't looking for fame. All he wanted to do was make a new CD for student camps and conferences that filled up his schedule. In fact, he went to the offices of Ardent Records in Memphis, talked to the former lead singer for DeGarmo and Key, Dana Key. And Dana Key was amazed. Todd wasn't looking just for a record deal. He had a vision to connect his God in such a way. And Dana liked this man. He saw in him a purity, not just a record deal. And his first major big hit was Grace Like Rain. Do you know that song has been purchased more than a million times and continues to be Christian music's top 250 most sung worship songs in America? After that, it was My Jesus, Our Great God, which he featured with Rebecca St. James, and In the Middle of Me and Your Great Name. I am really proud to produce, to present to you an artist, an extraordinary Christian communicator who loves the Lord Jesus Christ. And I want you to hear this morning the song that made his name well-known all over America. This is Grace Like Rain.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see so clearly.
Todd Agnew, I love the way he incorporated the song, the great hymn of the Christian faith, Amazing Grace, and how he kind of modernized it and put it together. This is a song that is a phenomenal song for him that has made his appearance well known. But Todd is not interested in fame and not interested in things like that. He's interested in communicating the grace the love of God, the majesty of God in his songs. And God has used this song, Grace Like Rain, as one of the most requested Christian worship songs all over the world. And it's amazing how God will take us in humble, small beginnings and for his purposes bless and exalt our ministry. And he has done that in Todd's sake. Now, a few things about Todd you may not know about. Maybe you're not really familiar with him. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. Concert audiences quickly learn that really there's much more to Todd than what they've heard on the radio. They may be familiar with the song Grace Like Rain, but do not know Todd as a Bible teacher. They may just know him as an artist singing In the Middle of Me, or just know him as a worship leader. And they may be acquainted with the deep honesty and the theology of his song, My Jesus, which we're going to hear soon. Todd's concert weaves these many threads into the compelling tapestry that is an honest telling of his life and music. In doing so, he creates a safe environment for his audience to take an honest look at themselves so that, together, artist and audience might have an authentic encounter with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So it's more than just a label, a name, a song. Todd wants to connect you with the Lord in his concerts. And we're going to hear just an example of how he does that in this song called Our Great God. This is Todd Agnew on the Soundcheck. Todd Agnew being joined by Rebecca St. James there, a nice duet, Our Great God, a song that connected lots of people with Todd's just praise of God in those lyrics. He's a very, very intelligent songwriter. I can understand why he connects well with his audience, and that is unique because so many times Christian artists, they don't connect as well because it becomes just a concert. And instead of a worship celebration. And I think God has used Todd in amazing ways to really connect the audience with his songs in a unique way. This next song is a very interesting one. It's another one of the songs well known by Todd Agnew. It's about missions, but it's also about God's majesty and how really they need to hear his voice more than ours. I want you to hear this. Todd Agnew, This Fragile Breath.
I could breathe, but no music.
a powerful, intense song. Great vocals, great music by Todd Agnew. This final song is perhaps the reason why I chose it to be the last song, is it's a provoking song, a thought-provoking song. Which version, if you will, of Jesus are you following? What do I mean? Well, there's a tendency for us as human beings to create God in our own image, for our own reasons and our own likeness. But he can't be put in a box. He is who he says he is, the great King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But there are many in the church today that may be following a version of Jesus that's not biblical. Think with me as you listen to this powerful song by Todd Agnew called My Jesus.
How you see him as he dies for your sins, but the word says he was battered and scarred. Did you miss that part? Sometimes I doubt we'd recognize him. I cry out loud. I wanna
prosperity, but like my Jesus. You see, I'm tired of living for success and popularity. I wanna be like my Jesus, but I'm not sure what that means to be like you, Jesus. 'Cause you said to live like you, to love like you. Then you died for me. Can I be like you, Jesus? I wanna be like you, Jesus. I wanna be like my Jesus.
It's been a real pleasure to have Todd Agnew today on the soundcheck. What a thought-provoking song. Would my Jesus be accepted at your church? It's so important that we're following Christ as he is presented in scriptures and not an invention of our own minds. Well, I just want to take the last few minutes to reflect on this extraordinary day. It's not every day that yours truly gets to talk to the son of the Shah of Iran. But I want to just say about Reza Pahlavi, a truly extraordinary man, extraordinary is the word, passionate is the word. He loves his country. He loves Iranians. Just the sound of his voice and what he shared today, it's very evident he is committed to their well-being, to their human rights, to their freedom. And if I were to take a moment to reflect on this day and think about every guest I've had on, I can only say that Mr. Reza Pahlavi has been just the most extraordinary guest I've ever had. I connect with him completely because that's what I do here on the cross in the desert, is I speak out and pray for Iranians, and I connect with his heart. I really feel a kinship with him, and I join Reza Pahlavi and everyone in Iran National Council and just commit with them to make a difference in the lives of Iranians all over the world. And I want to end today's broadcast with a simple reading of the Psalms that I have in my book. It is my commitment to you, Iranians. Just like Reza Pahlavi, I commit and partner with him in speaking hope and freedom to you, to your country. And God has a promise in his word that is really my motto for the cross in the desert. And I never want to forget to talk about this beautiful psalm because it's God's promise to bring hope and freedom to Iran. And this is what the psalm says, Psalm 72, verse 12. He will rescue the poor when they cry to him. He will help the oppressed who have no one to defend them. He feels pity for the weak and the needy, and he will rescue them. He will redeem them from oppression and violence, for their lives are precious to him. God's word is very clear. God is a God of promise and action. He will rescue. He will hear their cries. He will help the oppressed. He feels their pain. And he pities their condition, and he promises he will redeem them from oppression and violence. And I love the way this psalm ends, not because he just wants to, but because their lives, the lives of Iranians, are precious to him. When I first read this psalm on one of my broadcasts almost 3 years ago, I knew that this is the promise I want to always reflect on every program and give hope to Iranians through the word of God that he will rescue them. He will deliver them. When they cry to him, your prayers are never in vain. There is a time when God will bring swift and complete deliverance. I just want to say to everyone in the chat room, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this very special day and listening to this very special broadcast to be a voice of hope and freedom to Iranians. It is my passion, just like Reza Pahlavi's passion, to be a voice for them. And every time I do this broadcast, I'm reminded of God's promise to Iranians. And I believe that one day, very, very soon, we shall see the realization of this promise come true. It has been such a privilege today to connect with you on the Cross in the Desert. I hope that you will join me on the Monday edition of the Cross in the Desert, where we will again speak hope and freedom to Iran. God bless you and have an incredible weekend.
My night.